Chapter 5 Surf Dragons The Vikings' Woolen Sails The King's Mound My mother once told me she'd buy me a longship, a handsome oared vessel, to go sailing with Vikings, to stand at the stern post and steer a fine warship, then head back for harbour and hew down some foemen. Egil's Saga Sometime during the autumn of 1879, two teenage boys finally gave in to temptation. They had lived their entire lives on their father's farm in Sandefjord, a quiet coastal region 100 kilometres south of Oslo in Norway, and every inch of it was familiar to them. But an area in one of the fields had long piqued their interest. The Kongshaugen, or King's Mound as it was known locally, was an area of raised ground, or tumulus, around 45 metres in diameter, and by then some 5 metres high. It had likely been worn down by centuries of ploughing. The King's Mound, according to legend, contained treasure, or at least had at one time. The boys collected a couple of shovels and started to dig. The mound was indeed filled with treasure, although not the kind that they expected. Buried under layers of loamy soil were the thick oaken planks of a large and exceedingly old ship. After word of the discovery reached the University of Oslo, antiquarians swooped in and took over the excavation site. What they uncovered, after painstakingly brushing away the ship's earthen shroud, were the well-preserved remains of an enormous Viking longship. The Gokstad ship had been built around AD 850, and, after some 10 or 15 years at sea, it had been hauled ashore to play a central role in a lavish funeral. A burial chamber, clad in birch bark, had been built inside it. A bed contained the body of a tall, powerfully built man of middle age who, despite suffering from either arthritis or gout, had died a violent death, likely in battle. Some of his bones and many of the treasures that had been piled around his body had been looted long before by grave robbers, who seemed to have known precisely what they were looking for. A hole had been bored through the side of the mound directly into the burial chamber. They left behind the bones of 12 horses, 6 dogs, and a peacock that had been laid around the body. In normal circumstances, the structure of the boat would have been consumed by decay centuries ago. The secret to the Gokstad ship's longevity was the substance used to cover it. Once the royal occupant and his possessions had been interred, a thick layer of blue clay was plastered over it like marzipan on fruitcake, acting as a powerful preservative. The ship, now on show at the Viking Ship Museum in Oslo, is just over 23 metres long, 5.25 metres wide, and a shade under 2 metres deep, from the gunwale amidships to the bottom of the keel. She has been called the most beautiful ship ever built, and she is indeed quite something to look at. Lithe, almost sculptural. Over the course of the centuries spent under the earth, the sweeping lines of the wooden planks have darkened, so that they now appear almost charred. They are also surprisingly thin, making the ship light and flexible. Not usually a desirable quality in a boat, but apparently intentional. The hull weighs just 7 tons. Each flank is pieced with 16 oar holes, suggesting a muscle-bound crew of 32. But she also originally had a stout pine mast to help propel her across the waves. Inside the Gokstad, shreds of white and red double-thickness cloth were found, the ghostly remains of a woolen sail. Ships were integral to the Viking way of life. One expression of their importance was their use in death rites. Many ships were buried. It was perhaps believed that they would bear their inhabitants to the afterlife. Borre, to the west of Oslo Fjord, but still within sight of the sea, is now home to 7 mounds and a cairn. In antiquity, there were many more. Other ships were used as funeral pyres. Ibn Fadlan, a 10th century traveller fascinated by the Volga Vikings, he called them perfect physical specimens, tall as date palms, blonde and ruddy, left an intense description of a cremation ceremony in Risala, an account of his wanderings. Once the body of the dead man was sequestered in the ship's belly, one of his slave girls was summoned, and, in a gruesome ritual only half understood by Fadlan, raped by his attendants and stabbed to death before being laid by her master's side. This being done, the whole blood-soaked vessel was set aflame. The fire took hold of the pyre, then of the ship, then of the tent, and of the man and of the girl, and all that was in the ship. Ships took pride of place in Icelandic sagas too. They were given evocative, animalistic monikers: Oar Steed, Surf Dragon, Fjord Elk, Ocean Striding Bison, and Horse of the Lobster's Hearth. A flotilla was sometimes a fleet of the Otter's World. They were objects of pride and power. According to legend, an enormous vessel was built for King Olaf in 998. Long Serpent could carry 200 armed men and had room for 34 pairs of oarsmen. Other sagas talk of ships with 70-foot masts. A century or so ago, such tales were scoffed at. Now that ships have been found by archaeologists measuring nearly 40 metres from bow to stern, this seems less preposterous. The queen of all the Viking ships, however, never existed. Skithblathnir was, according to Norse mythology, built by dwarves for the god Frey. Of course, she was also magical. Large enough to carry the entire Norse pantheon with all their weapons, she had been so cunningly wrought that when not in use, Frey could fold her up like a fine piece of cloth to be carried in a pocket. Skithblathnir's greatest attribute, however, was her sails. No matter when and where the ship lay when the sails were hoisted, a strong, powerful wind sprang up, ready to take her precisely where she needed to go. Art was imitating life here. While there are many aspects of Viking longships that make enthusiasts go weak at the knees, it was the sails that lent these ships their power and their reach. Violent, daring raids on defenseless towns and monasteries have become a leitmotif of stories told about the Vikings. Certainly they used their prowess as seamen to outmaneuver and surprise their enemies. Longboats, which sat high up in the water, didn't need harbours and could be beached almost anywhere, making many more places vulnerable to attack. But Vikings were also traders, nosing their longboats up rivers to reach important trading ports around Europe and into the Black Sea, and played an active role in the western fringes of the Silk Roads. Bustling back and forth between trading posts, their ships weighed down with ivory from walrus tusks, amber, falcons, human slaves, or furs from the far north. Marten, beaver, and winter squirrel were especially prized in continental Europe. Numerous silken textiles have been found in Scandinavian graves that were woven as far afield as China and Persia. In fact, there is evidence that Arabic patterns and texts, or even designs that appeared Islamic in origin, were popular status symbols. Using ships packed with preserved food, such as pickled herring, lamb smoked over reindeer droppings, and fermented salmon, Norse people were able to travel vast distances. These boats weren't always sailing vessels. Ancient Scandinavian people used dugouts or skin boats, and rowed warships allowed the Angles to reach England in the 5th century. Nevertheless, the sail allowed the Vikings to get further and travel faster, laying open much more of the world. Because of their skill as boat builders and sailors, waterways became roadways rather than obstacles. They settled new lands and invigorated cultures by importing new art forms and customs. Vikings populated Iceland and Greenland. The number of people living on the former jumped from 0 to 70,000 over just 60 years, as boatloads of people arrived seeking better lives. They conquered Normandy and parts of Italy, and also reached Ireland, England, Fair Isle, Shetland, the Black Sea, even America. Archaeologists are best known for using tools such as brushes, trowels, and buckets. Sarah Parkak has another rather unconventional piece of equipment in her armory, satellites. Using imagery taken from cameras 383 miles above the Earth's surface, she searches for irregularities in the soil and in the growth of vegetation, tantalizing evidence of structures that once stood there. Using this technique, she has been able to pinpoint previously undiscovered and undisturbed cultural sites in Egypt, Peru, and the old Roman Empire, even identifying the site of an ancient lighthouse near Rome. In 2016, however, she trained her satellite's lenses a little closer to home. Most of what we know about the Viking journey to America and their time there comes from the Icelandic sagas. As sources, these aren't ideal. They tend to emphasize things that made the Norsemen, or even the individual poets and families that told them, look particularly brave and daring. Lavish descriptions are given to battles and heroic deaths. The work of women is all but invisible. Two sagas mention Vinland, a place west of Greenland with excellent hunting, plentiful timber for boat building, well-stocked rivers, and juicy laden vines, hence the name. This paradise, in fact, only had one metaphorical serpent. The Skraelings, or wretched people, as the Vikings called them, were the land's original inhabitants, and they bitterly resented the incursions of the newcomers, shooting at them with bows and arrows. So violent did their attacks become that after just a few years, the new colony was abandoned entirely, and, according to the sagas, the Norsemen sailed home. Suspicions that Vinland was, in fact, America, were rife in the 19th century. In 1893, an exact replica of the newly unearthed Gokstad, christened Viking to hammer home the point, was made by a shipbuilder determined to prove that a journey from Norway to America by longboat was possible. Captained by Magnus Andersen, the Viking set off westward from Bergen on Sunday the 30th of April, with a dozen men, 30 tons of cargo, and 1,000 bottles of beer. They reached Newfoundland on the 27th of May and were greeted by curious crowds and a punch toast in New London on the 14th of June. It had been a hair-raising and stormy voyage, but it nevertheless seemed to confirm that the long-speculated journey from the land of the Vikings to America in a longboat was at least possible. In a strong head sea, the keel could move up and down as much as 3/4 of an inch, Andersen later wrote. But strangely enough, the ship stayed completely watertight. More definitive proof that the Vikings really did reach America has followed. In 1960, a pair of archaeologists found the remnants of a Viking settlement at Lancer Meadows in Newfoundland that dated back to AD 1000. A copper coin discovered in Maine had been struck in Scandinavia sometime between 1065 and 1080. During the reign of King Olaf III. Using her satellite technology, Sarah Parkak has been searching for other potential Viking outposts in the New World. One promising location was Point Rosie in Canada, a windswept and seemingly inhospitable peninsula stretching out into the Gulf of St. Lawrence in Newfoundland, 400 miles southwest of Lancer Meadows. Parkak zeroed in on this area because of odd areas of discoloration in the images that appeared to show the outline of a previously unnoticed man-made structure. When she and her team began digging in 2016, immediately they almost found what appeared to be a hearth. Although it didn't look like much more than a blackened rock, further digging showed that it may have been used to roast iron ore, and 28 pounds of slag were found in a nearby pit. Point Rosie may not be another Viking settlement in North America. Research is ongoing, but so far no conclusive evidence has been found. One thing that is no longer in doubt, however, is that the Viking mastery of ships and sails enabled them to reach America 500 years before Christopher Columbus. Shipshape. The high wind out on the fjords scraped the wind-blown sail in the difficult conditions. Sigvater the Skald, 11th century. During the mid-18th century, Captain James Cook travelled around the globe, visiting Pacific Islands nations that had previously been unknown and invisible to the Western world. Cook owed a great deal of his success on this leg of his journey to a Polynesian man he met along the way. Tupaia was a leader from Raiatea who joined Cook's crew and soon became indispensable, helping to mediate between the Western sailors and the islanders who they encountered. One of the most incredible things he did, however, was to draw a map from memory that showed nothing less than the entirety of his known world. Although it was far from perfect, and it certainly didn't help that the English officers helping him kept on mixing up the Tahitian words for north and south, Tupaia's map showed almost every major island group in Polynesia and Fiji. Its range, in fact, extended some 2,600 miles, well over the width of the United States, and contained a wealth of information essential to navigation: currents, weather, swells, and winds. More incredible still, the area Tupaia was able to depict far exceeded the voyaging range at that time of his people. In reality, Tupaia's map was not his. It was a distillation of knowledge accumulated over many generations and gained during countless long and dangerous sea voyages that had long since ended. History is full of miraculous journeys accomplished thanks to lengths of fabric fashioned into sails and the boats bobbing beneath them. Over the past 50,000 years, man has used them to reach even the most isolated islands, scattered like lost beads over the world's surface. It is believed that the relatively short journeys, island hopping, normal during the late Pleistocene age, gave way nearly 12,000 years ago to longer, more ambitious journeys. The remotest islands were colonized by humans only during the last millennium. How exactly this happened, however, and what the crafts used by the earliest seafarers looked like, is often unknowable. In the absence of evidence, attempts have been made to recreate these exploits. The most famous example is that of the Kon-Tiki expedition. On the 27th of April 1947, the Norwegian writer and explorer Thor Heyerdahl hoisted sail on a crude raft made of balsa logs and set off from Lima, headed for French Polynesia. His aim was to test a theory that the Polynesian islands had been settled by people from South America rather than Asia. Although he was able to make the journey, it took 101 days, during which he passed the time catching sharks, and the raft held together, his theory has now largely been debunked. Others have used linguistic clues to make inferences about these earliest journeys. When Captain Cook visited the Pacific, he speculated that many of the Polynesian islands he visited were colonized by the same wave of peoples, because of the similarities in their languages. More intriguingly still, the words for mast, sail, and outrigger boom appear to be the oldest in the Austronesian spoken in the most isolated Philippine and Indonesian archipelagos, further suggesting that it was the technology of sailing boats that spread humanity over some of the remotest stretches of the globe. Neither the boats nor the sails we are familiar with today sprang fully formed from a single mind. They are the products of millennia of wisdom and experience, slowly accreted, like coral reefs, or indeed Tupaia's map. The earliest boats were likely made from bundles of reeds, and their sails animal skins drawn over a framework of sticks or hollowed-out logs. The oldest known vessel is the 3-meter-long Pessa canoe, thought to have been hewn from a Scots pine log 10,000 years old in what is now the Netherlands. Such simple craft, however, would have been unable to cope long with the sea conditions. Longer, rougher journeys required better boats that were more stable and able to hold together when lashed by waves and wind. Sails were a separate innovation. Their function is to harness the wind to drive a craft over water. But from such a simple premise, a million possibilities bloom. Indeed, the flock of historical sails is so densely populated, it requires an entire language to describe it. They come in myriad sizes and shapes, claw, square, and lateen, some of which are unique to a particular class of ship, such as the traditional Indonesian pinisi, or the latest monohull racing moth. Modern sails are usually made of synthetic fabrics, such as dacron, nylon, or Kevlar. However, the sails used to make all the near-miraculous voyages up until the invention of the steamship in the 19th century, and many more since then, were woven from natural fibres, linen, cotton, hemp, and wool. Without the production of fabrics to make sailcloth, daring voyages from Cheng He's 15th century expeditions around Southeast Asia to Roald Amundsen's conquest of the Northwest Passage would have been impossible. For a long time, Egypt seemed the most likely birthing place for sails. Ancient Egyptian civilization clustered around the Nile, a river that flows from south to north, while the prevailing wind usually blows in the opposite direction. This means that while it was possible to drift down the Nile, sailing back up it would have been advantageous. It was speculated that the notion of using a square of linen came from the practice of hoisting ceremonial shields in the centre of boats, a practice depicted in antiquity. These would have caught the wind and helped to move the boat against the flow of the water. Corroborating evidence for such a theory comes in the form of hieroglyphs. One meaning sail upstream shows a boat with a sail. The one meaning head downstream shows a craft with a steering oar but no sail. Newer findings, however, seem to have eclipsed this neat theory. Mesopotamian pottery dating from the 6th and 5th millennia BC has been unearthed in many sites in East Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and Qatar, usually along the coast. For years, archaeologists have seen this as a tantalizing indication of travel by sea, but direct evidence was lacking. Until, that is, As-Sabiha, an archaeological site on what was once a sheltered Gulf Bay, yielded barnacle-encrusted fragments believed to come from a reed bundle boat, a ceramic model of a similar boat and a painted ceramic disc, 7 centimetres in diameter, depicting a vessel with a bipod mast, the earliest known evidence for the use of a mast and sail in the world. Although the classic longboat of popular imagination always has a sail, they were a rather late addition to Scandinavian ships. Tacitus, who lived in the 1st century, mentioned the unusual Norse boats in Germania. The form of their vessels varies thus far from ours that they have prows at each end, so as to be always ready to row to shore without turning, nor are they moved by sails, nor on their sides have benches of oars places, but the rowers ply here and there. It wasn't until some centuries later that sails were finally adopted, likely because they made it easier to propel larger cargoes of goods and men from one port to another, something that the Vikings, as traders or raiders, and certainly as colonizers, increasingly found pivotal to their way of life. The Gotland picture stones, found in Sweden, show rowing boats in the 6th century, and simple craft with masts and square sails from the 7th, often with plaited or checkered patterns, techniques that may have been decorative, but which some hypothesize made the sails stronger. Elaborate sailing ships are shown by the 11th century. As is the case with many late adopters, the Norsemen proved to be zealous converts. This was natural enough. Sails dramatically expanded their horizons, allowing them to travel further, with larger loads, and giving them a crucial edge against their rivals. By the time of King Canute's North Sea Empire during the first half of the 11th century, the fleet, encompassing everything from the grandest warship to the humblest fishing vessel would have required around 1 million square miles of sailcloth. The majority of this would have been made from wool. From flock to fleet. And then by the mast, a certain sea raiment, the sail, was made fast by a rope. The sea timber groaned. The wind did not hinder that buoyant craft in her journey over the waves. The seagoer fared. Beowulf, circa AD 975 to 1025. During the late autumn of 1989, the small church in Trondenes, a small parish on a ragged spit of land in northern Norway, was finally renovated. It was long overdue. White with a steep-sided red roof, the church crouches right at the water's edge. It has the distinction of being the northernmost medieval stone church in the country. As the workmen repaired the roof, they found odd wads and pads stuffed between the wooden boards in the roof and in gaps in the masonry. These proved to be pieces of cloth so old and dirty and stiff that they resembled strips of leather. Upon closer examination, however, it was discovered that the scraps that had been used to fill the gaps in the roof were pieces of wadmal, coarse woolen cloth, that had once served a very different purpose. Several hundred years earlier, this cloth had been made to catch and hold the wind as a sail on a Norse ship. Wool doesn't seem an obvious material from which to fashion sails. Its natural warmth, the quality for which it has traditionally been prized, isn't of use in this instance. Indeed, part of what gives wool its warmth are the crimps that occur in the individual fibres, which help to trap insulating pockets of air when woven together. But the crimps also mean that woolen fabric is full of tiny holes through which air can escape, not ideal when trying to harness the wind. And as anyone who has ever washed a woolen sweater can attest, it will absorb a lot of water, becoming very heavy, and takes a long time to dry. Given such disadvantages, it seems amazing that anyone ever thought of using wool to make sails, and yet not only were such sails standard issue for longboats, but they were also used by the Vikings when they traded goods across Europe and, most likely, made the long voyage to and from America. It might be tempting to believe that the moment alternatives were readily available, wool would have been abandoned. Quite the contrary, as it turns out. Square woolen sails were still being made in Scandinavia and in the Faroe Islands into the 20th century. That the Trondenes scraps of fabric survived to be studied is something of a miracle. Woolen sails were worn out and then disposed of, so without the Trondenes pieces, the archaeological record for Viking sails would be scanty indeed. And although they don't look like much now, they have provided shoals of researchers rich insights into the making and performance of Norse vessels. We know from what kind of sheep the wool originated, and how it was processed, woven, and stitched together. We can answer many questions about how well such sails performed in practice, and what the sensory experience of sailing beneath them might have been. One shred that had been wadded up in the church roof even proved, when smoothed out, to contain a perfectly preserved eyelet, through which a rope would once have run, carefully sewn by unknown hands, sometime between 1280 and 1420. The story of how the Viking sails were made begins, as tales about woolen things usually do, with sheep. The islands that lie between Norway, Scotland, and Iceland have been known for their sheep and for the quality of their knitters for hundreds of years. Fair Islanders, for example, have been bartering woolens with passing seamen since the 1600s and even fulfilled a special order of 100 sweaters for a 1902 Antarctic expedition. Although most of the people buying Fair Isle sweaters today don't know it, the breed of sheep from which this bounty originates are unusual. Primitive sheep are smaller and provide a good deal less wool and meat than their burly modern rivals, such as the Romney and Merino, that produce the wool used in most clothing and furnishings today. But what these North Atlantic sheep lack in heft, they more than make up for in hardiness and stubborn adaptability. They can, for the most part, fend for themselves, without the cosseting their modern kin require. They can also survive, even thrive, on a very rough diet. Those native to North Ronaldsay, the northernmost of the Orkney Islands, have adapted to eat seaweed almost exclusively, picking their way over the slippery rocks near the seashore and shunning lusher, greener fare. These hardier sheep would have been approved of by Vikings, whose Old Norse, short-tailed breeds they resemble. Viking sheep, too, would have been around the size of a large dog, half the size of more popular modern breeds, grazed on rough heather moorland rather than grassy pasture, and would have lived semi-wild, only coming into close contact with their owners once or twice a year. Most flocks were likely small, perhaps around a dozen animals, kept by smallholders who also farmed or fished. This was certainly the case in 1657, when a tax list was drawn up that included all the sheep in Norway, some 329,000. Their wool is crucially different, too. Not only did their coats come in a variety of colours, black and brown as well as white, but their fleeces were made up of two layers, a wiry outer one covering a soft, highly insulating underwool. This isn't common in the most widely farmed sheep today. Another oddity of the wool of the Old Norse sheep was its high lanolin content, which makes it more water repellent, an excellent quality for making sails. Because of the small scale of sheep farming, procuring sufficient quantities to supply a large vessel with sails would have required sustained and coordinated efforts from several households. Double-coated sheep shed their wool naturally in the late spring and summer when the weather warms up. The flocks would have been rounded up around midsummer and the loose wool pulled or rued by hand. This is hard work. At the Fosen Folk High School in Risha, where traditional skills are still taught, it takes four or five people 10 minutes or so to pull away all the loose hanks of wool from a single sheep. While more time-consuming than shearing, ruing has its advantages. Plucked wool is more water-resistant, and less carding or combing needs to be done to get rid of the short, new-growth woolen fibres that shearing includes. The wool would have been sorted as it was gathered. The finest wool comes from a sheep's neck. This would be reserved for luxurious shawls, while wool from the thighs is best for hard-wearing mittens or socks. Especially prized is the wool from unmated 3-year-old sheep, said to be especially tough and thick. Once the ruing and sorting were complete, the wool would be twisted into hanks and stored in animal hide bags cured with fish oil until later in the year. The bulk of the real work would be conducted during the autumn and winter months, when the days are short and time is best spent indoors and out of the cold. First, the entire family would likely have gathered to tease out the long outer fleece from the softer underwool. This was of particular importance when sail making. The latter would then have been sprinkled with fish oil and set aside, so that the oil would have time to penetrate the fibres, making them softer still. Next came the work that was predominantly done by women: spinning, weaving, and finishing. The long coarse fibres would be combed out and, using a drop spindle, spun tightly clockwise to create very strong yarns. These would be used for the warp, which needed to be waterproof and withstand the tensile stress and strain of the wind. The underwool was given gentler treatment and loosely spun anti-clockwise. This softer, looser thread would be used for the weft, when fulled, a process by which the fibres are rubbed so that they begin to clump together. The soft fibres would then create a denser and more windproof surface. Making these two kinds of thread required skill and a good deal of time. Someone with particular expertise can produce between 30 and 50 metres of yarn each hour using a spindle and distaff. Even so, a large sail of 90 metres square or so represents the labour of around 2.5 modern working years. When it came to weaving, there was a good deal of local variation. The looms used were likely simple, warp-weighted ones, and while most sailcloth was some variation of a twill, which makes the finished fabric look as if it has diagonal lines going through it, sailmakers from Iceland favoured a 2-2 twill, while those from Sweden and Denmark used a 2-1 or two-skept variant during the Viking era. The weight of the cloth varied according to the size of the intended sail. For one of around 100 metres square, a heavy cloth would be woven. Smaller boats would require something far lighter. It was time-consuming work. A single metre of sailcloth would take around 20 hours to weave. The cloth was then fulled, which stabilised its size, something that is important if making a piece of cloth that will be used in wet, windy conditions. Fulling was something done using special felting boards, or the cloth would simply be placed just within the tide line and weighted down with stones, letting the ebb and flow of the water do the job. The fulled cloth would then be stretched, dried, and, because the looms were usually far narrower than the sails needed to be, several pieces of cloth, known as webs, would be sewn together into the final iconic square shape. Although here too there was regional variety. On the Faroe Islands, looms were able to weave cloth lengths of about 5 metres, enough to make a Faroese square sail. The finishing touch was a two-stage process known as smearing. First, the fabric would be brushed with a mixture of water, horse fat or fish oil, and ochre, a naturally occurring reddish earth. When this had dried, hot liquid beef tallow or fir tar would be smoothed into the sail. The greasing helped smooth out differences between individual webs so that the air would flow easily over the joins, while the particles of ochre plugged the gaps between the woolen fibres. Modern tests on cloth made to the Vikings' exacting standards show that while fulled but untreated fabric has around 30% less air permeability than its unfulled equivalent, the finished, smeared cloth had an airflow close to zero, dramatically increasing its effectiveness as a sail. So well were these sails crafted that, if maintained correctly, they might be expected to last 40 or 50 years. Making the textiles, and particularly the technically challenging sails, would have required more effort than making the ship itself. While it has been estimated that it would take 2 skilled shipwrights a fortnight to make a longboat, creating a sail would take 2 equally skilled women a full year or more, depending on the size required. Although we cannot be sure exactly what the Trondenis builders were thinking when they caught up the old woolen sail when plugging the gaps in their roof, we do know why it was there in the first place. Just as the making of sails was a communal affair, so too was their maintenance. In 1309, King Håkon V passed a law that made different regions responsible for maintaining and equipping one ship for use in times of war. According to this law, the sail and other equipment used in the protection of the country shall be kept in the church, in keeping with ancient tradition. The picture this gives is of small communities working together to outfit a ship and local sailors. This also explains why there was a wealth of regional variety in sailcloth and, perhaps, why the work was done so well. Clothes and sails made at home on winter evenings would likely come to be used by brothers, sons, husbands, and fathers. Recent attempts at experimental archaeology, building and making ships to Viking specifications using clues gleaned from the Trondenis scraps, have given fascinating insights into what it might actually have been like sailing in a ship powered by wool. For one thing, it was assumed that the square sails usual for Viking longboats would be inefficient, only allowing boats to sail downwind. This is not the case. Faithful recreations have been able to operate at around 50 degrees into the wind, some 5 degrees off what would be expected from a modern sailing ship. Sail away. A furore Normannorum, libera nos, O Domine. From the Norseman's fury, deliver us, O Lord. European prayer, 9th and 10th centuries. In July AD 793, disaster struck a Northumbrian monastery in the northeast of England, And they came to the church of Lindisfarne, a chronicler wrote afterward, laid everything to waste with grievous plundering, trampled the holy places with polluted feet, dug up the altars, and seized all the treasures of the holy church. Even the holy brothers themselves were not inviolate. Some were killed, others drowned in the sea or taken away in fetters, presumably bound for a life of slavery. The villains of the peace, of course, were Viking raiders, and the shock of their attack on Lindisfarne reverberated throughout Christendom. Alcuin of York, an English scholar, wrote outrage letters to all the powerful people he could think of. "Never before," he thundered in his missive to King Ethelred, "has such terror appeared in Britain, as we have now suffered from a pagan race." Christian Europe was to suffer many more such affronts in the coming years, and panic quickly spread. What made these attacks all the more galling was that up until then, the sea had been seen as a protective barrier rather than a means of transportation. Alcuin hinted at precisely this in his letter to Ethelred, nor was it thought that such an inroad from the sea could be made. So unshakable had this belief been that many religious houses had, like Lindisfarne, been built on rather desolate spits of land, with the sea lapping close by on all sides. But these made perfect locations for Viking raiders, whose longboats didn't need deep harbours and who, if the fight turned against them, although presumably it rarely did, could make fast getaways. More attacks followed. The next year, religious houses at Wearmouth and Jarrow, where Bede the Venerable had once lived, were raided. The monastery on the island of Iona was attacked the year after that, and then again in 802 and 806, so that it was almost utterly despoiled. At Port Mahomach in Scotland, now a small fishing village, but then the home of a prosperous religious community, excavations have revealed evidence of another violent assault. As well as a layer of sooty ashes and fragments of smashed sculptures, a piece of skull was discovered that bears a deep cleft likely made by the blade of a sword. Although we cannot know for sure, it is a fair guess that the arm wielding the sword belonged to a Norseman. It is odd, bearing in mind the angular fierceness of the Viking image, to remember how crucial soft woolen yarns were to their way of life. Without them, in fact, Vikings would have been quite different. Ships and sailor warriors may have been the ones romanticized and celebrated in poetry to this day, but woolen cloth, and those who made it, underpinned their success. Well into the 20th century, Norwegian seamen headed out for 3 months sailing would take 3 changes of underwear, a shirt, 5 pairs of sea mittens, 2 pairs of ordinary mittens, and similar numbers of leggings and stockings, mostly made using a kind of crochet or single-needle knitting technique known as nolabinding. All of these garments were traditionally made of wool and needed frequent darning and replenishing. Especially lucky sailors, those who could afford it, might also have a luxuriantly thick sailor's blanket called a sjoria, each one of which demanded the wool of 17 sheep. Many explanations have been proffered as to why the Vikings exploded out of their home nation to explore the world. Some have suggested that an expansion in the production of iron allowed better tools to be made. Others have pointed to a rising population, growth in international trade, and even a period of global warming resulting in better harvests. Another theory centres on wool itself. As the Vikings began to travel and trade more, their need for wool would have increased correspondingly. More boats meant more sails and sailors' clothing, more textiles, more sheep, and land to pasture them on. In fact, the spiralling need for land, sheep, and wool is argued by some, including textile historian Lisa Bender Jorgensen, to be at least partially responsible for their aggressive expansion into new lands, such as Normandy, Greenland, and indeed America. Outfitting an ordinary Viking cargo ship and its crew, including sailcloth, sailors' clothing, and bedding, is estimated to have required over 200 kilograms of wool and the equivalent of 10 years' labour. For a particularly large warship, with a crew of perhaps 70 men, the figures are monstrous. 1.5 tons of wool, and up to 60 years' labour. The production of such immense quantities of fabric represents a huge investment by a large community of people, the majority of them women. Given that the annual yield of one Old Norse sheep is only between 1 and 2.5 kilograms, with only perhaps 500 grams suitable for sailcloth, the number of sheep needed would also have been staggering. By some estimates, the sailcloth of the Norwegian Viking-era fleet would have required wool from up to 2 million sheep.